This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at two upcoming cases that the Supreme Court is considering that may threaten affirmative action.
Heidi Boghossian and I, Marjorie Cohn, will speak with Professor Jason Williamson about the high stakes involved with these two cases that will be heard on Halloween.
We'll also speak with author Luca Falciola about his new book on militant attorneys.
We will talk about the history of the National Lawyers Guild and how activist lawyers represent their clients.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. In 2003, the Supreme Court held in the case of Grutter versus Bollinger that the 14th Amendment allows public universities to consider race as a factor to assemble a diverse student body. The court reaffirmed that holding in 2016. There are now two cases pending on the court's docket that it may well use to overrule Grutter and gut affirmative action. The court will hear oral argument in these two cases on October 31st. The Students for Fair Admissions is suing Harvard and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, asking the court to overturn Grutter. The group says its mission is helping, quote, to restore colorblind principles to our nation's schools, colleges, and universities, unquote. Colorblind is a euphemism for allowing the conditions that created the racial inequality and unequal opportunity to continue. UNC Chapel Hill, wrote education journalist Nick Anderson in the Washington Post, was founded to educate the enslaving elite of this southern state, allied for generations with the cause of white supremacy, roiled by racial tensions in recent years over the fate of a Confederate monument and treatment of black faculty members. On October 4th, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Merrill versus Milligan, which the conservative majority will likely use to uphold Alabama's racist gerrymandered district map. During argument, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson mentioned the race-conscious goal of the drafters of the 14th Amendment, who were, quote, trying to ensure that people who had been discriminated against were actually brought equal to everyone else in society. That's not a race-neutral or race-blind idea, unquote, Jackson said. With the radical right-wing supermajority on the Supreme Court, it is likely that the court will outlaw affirmative action using the so-called colorblind rationale. We are fortunate to have with us today on Law and Disorder, Jason Williamson, Executive Director of the Center on Race, Inequality, and the Law at New York University School of Law. Professor Williamson, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
What is the factual background of the case involving the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill?
So in November of 2014, the Students for Fair Admissions filed a lawsuit against the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, alleging that the university's race-conscious admissions program violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It is notable that the lawsuit was filed on the same day that the same litigants, the Students for Fair Admission, filed their companion lawsuit against Harvard University, which we will get to shortly, I imagine. And a few, I think, important background notes to keep in mind. One is that, in case anyone was unsure, I think the way that this litigation has played out makes it clear that this was a concerted, organized effort to get this issue back in front of what I think the plaintiffs believe would be a much more sympathetic Supreme Court. It is true that the SFFA is a membership organization, but it It's also true that the organization was created for the purpose of bringing these lawsuits and was founded by a gentleman named Edward Bloom, who also created the project on fair representation. And these are folks who have been, you know, actively recruiting Asian American and Pacific Islander students to serve as plaintiffs in these cases. This is not a situation where, you know, there's a huge groundswell of support for these positions, but these folks were able to develop some momentum and bring these cases. But I think it's noteworthy that in the North Carolina case and in the Harvard case, the defendants argued originally that the SFFA didn't even have standing to bring this case because it was so obviously clear what was going on here, and that these were allegations that were not necessarily coming from individual students who had complaints, but coming from folks who have ideological problems with race-conscious admissions programs. I think it's also worth noting, and I think it's part of the reason that Chapel Hill was chosen as a defendant, is that it is the oldest public university in the country. And so to the extent that that adds some extra weight to what the court does here, I think that was a deliberate decision on the part of the plaintiffs. But ironically, you know, the fact that the University of North Carolina has been around so long means that it has that much more to overcome in its history of discrimination and racism, which it now acknowledges and is trying to counter through this program and other efforts. You know, the court, the district court that heard the case originally made clear that part of why it makes sense for the school to continue down this road is that it still has a lot of work to do to undo the harm that was caused by so many years of discrimination and exclusion, not just at the university, but in North Carolina generally. So I just want to be clear that is the context in which the case was filed. This didn't just sort of happen out of nowhere or sort of as part of some spontaneous or grassroots effort.
Just to clarify the facts, Jason, were the plaintiffs alleging that they had not been admitted to the university?
Yes, in a sense. I mean, they were alleging that they were not being given a fair opportunity as applicants to the university because of the metrics and things that the university was using to move through its race-conscious admission procedure, and that procedure was or is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause because it excludes or discriminates against, in particular, Asian American students and other students who don't fit within the box of Black or Latinx students.
Okay. And can you please explain what Title VI and the 14th Amendment to the Constitution say?
Sure. So it's a good question because I think this is one of the things that distinguishes the two cases. The case against the University of North Carolina was brought under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, as I said, which states, at least in relevant part, that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. The key there is that the Equal Protection Clause applies to state actors, which is to say the government. It does not extend to private actors or private entities. And that's why in the Harvard case, Harvard being a private institution that is not subject to the 14th Amendment, the plaintiffs brought that suit under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And Title VI states that, there's some very similar language, but it states that no person in the United States shall, on the ground of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. So you can probably see from that language what the framers were trying to do there, which is to find ways to hold private actors accountable for racial discrimination outside of the context of the Constitution, which, as I said, applies only to state actors. And so here, Harvard was subject to the suit under Title VI because, like most private universities, it gets some form of federal assistance, even if it's not particularly significant. So again, this is more evidence that there was a concerted effort here to target one public institution, one private institution, and to tailor the legal claims accordingly, but essentially making the same argument.
So what is the position of the University of North Carolina, the defendant in that case? What are they arguing?
Well, of course, they argue that their race-conscious admissions program is entirely constitutional. More specifically, that it is faithful to the guidelines laid out in Supreme Court precedent, particularly in the 2003 Grutter case. And so, you know, they are relying on the court's prior decision to guide their efforts to craft a program that meets constitutional requirements or meets the requirements of the Equal Protection Clause. So they argue that, you know, diversity continues to be a compelling interest for them to pursue, both because it benefits students of color, but also because it benefits the educational community at large, and ultimately the greater public, because you're talking about educating people who are going to go out in the world and be leaders and have to interact with folks from all different backgrounds and perspectives. So it's obviously something that is important, and the program is narrowly tailored to achieve the desired result, which is part of the legal test if one is going to have this sort of race-conscious admissions program. The university's position is that their job is to evaluate the whole student, right, and that they are using race as one factor of many in evaluating whether or not a particular student will be a good fit for that, for the university. They are not prepared to base those decisions entirely or even primarily on test scores and GPAs, which, while they may be more objective in some ways, fail to capture all of the ways in which students can add value to a college campus. And by the way, the courts below agreed with them, so they obviously have made a compelling case that the program that they have in place now is both necessary and in compliance with the legal test that the Supreme Court has laid out.
Jason, can you explain the factual background of the Harvard case?
Sure. So, as I said, the Harvard case was filed on the same day in September of 2014 as the North Carolina case. It was filed by the same litigants. I think probably the biggest difference in terms of the background here is that the Harvard case was filed in the wake of a 2012 article published by New York Times columnist David Brooks, accusing Harvard of intentionally discriminating against Asian and Asian American applicants based on the achievement numbers of Asian American high school students versus the percentages of Asian American students that were being admitted to Harvard. And I think, you know, that was part of the momentum that the Students for Fair Admissions got behind in filing their case. I would note again that this is, you know, all of this was deliberate. So just as the University of North Carolina is the oldest public university in the country, Harvard is the oldest private university in the country. So plaintiffs were obviously trying to make a point here and also, again, point to the history of discrimination at Harvard and why we should be skeptical of Harvard's statements about, you know, the importance of diversity and so on. I think, again, it's, to me, ironic because Harvard certainly does have a long history of discrimination and racism and white supremacy. And for that reason, the program that they have in place was necessary when it was put in place, and it continues to be necessary because the work is not yet finished. The other thing, I think, you know, this is, again, related to the article that Mr. Brooks wrote, I think there was much more emphasis in the Harvard case on what the plaintiff suggested was intentional discrimination against Asian applicants, where that was sort of less of a touch point in the North Carolina case.
So is the plaintiff alleging in both of these lawsuits or arguing that race should not be considered at all in admissions decisions?
Yeah, that's a great question, because one of the arguments that the SFFA made at the district court level was exactly that, that race should not be considered at all, and that the Equal Protection Clause contemplates a colorblind constitution, which is to say that race should never be taken into account in any instance. A couple things about that. Number one, that argument, of course, flies completely in the face of established Supreme Court precedent in Grutter, which says clearly that race can be considered, and then there's a whole conversation or discussion about how race can be considered and the different metrics that can be used and so forth. But to argue that race shouldn't be or is impermissibly considered was way beyond the pale, so much so that claim was thrown out before it even got up to the Supreme Court. But I think what that sort of foreshadows, and I think the most concerning argument here that the plaintiffs are making in both of these cases is that Grutter and all of its progeny, all of the cases that have followed it, including the Fisher case in 2016, should be overruled. That is precedent that should be overturned, which of course is not a small matter, at least it shouldn't be in the United States Supreme Court, but they have clearly are trying to seize on an opportunity to get in front of a court that may very well be prepared to do that.
Jason, which members of the Supreme Court who ruled in Grutter are still on the court, and how did they vote in that case?
Good question. So Grutter, Grutter was decided in 2003. It was a 5-4 decision. Justice Thomas is actually the only member of that court who remains on the court today. The five justices that ruled in favor of allowing the program to move forward, stating that it did not violate the Equal Protection Clause, of Justice O'Connor, who authored the decision, Justice Stevens, Justice Souter, Justice Ginsburg, and Justice Breyer, who, as you know, just recently retired. And the four dissenters included Justice Rehnquist, who was the Chief Justice at the time, Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy, and, as I mentioned, Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas, by the way, wrote a pretty vigorous dissent in that case as well.
This is Marjorie Cohn with my co-host Heidi Boghossian talking to Professor Jason Williamson about the two cases that the Supreme Court may use to completely demolish affirmative action. Jason, what did the Supreme Court decide in the 2016 case of Fisher versus University of Texas?
So the Fisher case really just upheld the University of Texas' use of race as one factor in its holistic review of applicants, following the guidance that was laid out in Grutter 13 years before that. So they found that the Texas's program served a compelling state interest and that it was narrowly tailored in the way that it needed to be in order to achieve the stated goal, but without causing harm, and that the University of Texas had had concrete goals and a clear explanation for their approach. You know, you may know that the Texas had, prior to that, implemented a program that they referred to as the Top 10% Plan, where they would automatically admit all students who graduated within the top 10% of their class at every high school across the state, with the hope that that would create a more diverse student body. And what they found that while it was helpful, it did not get them all the way there, and that the race-conscious admissions program that they put in place was an effort to fill the gap and to sort of add to that effort, but in a more kind of deliberate way. And the court found that that was permissible, that there was no violation of the Equal Protection Clause, and importantly, that there were no other available alternatives for Texas, the University of Texas, to use in order to achieve, again, what everyone agrees is a compelling interest in making sure that students are able to interact with other people from diverse backgrounds and perspectives, and that they will be prepared to go out into the world and be effective leaders.
And Jason, which members of the Supreme Court who ruled in Fisher are still on the court, and how did they vote in that case?
Yeah, so this one's a little more complicated, just because it was a 4-3 vote. Only 7 members of the court weighed in here, and that's because Justice Kagan, who had joined the court not long before that, recused herself because of her prior involvement in the case in her role as Solicitor General. And although Justice Scalia participated in the oral argument in the case, he died in February 2016, just prior to the court's decision. And so the 4 justices that voted to uphold the Texas program were Justice Kennedy, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer, and Justice Sotomayor, and in dissent were Justices Thomas, Roberts, and Alito. One thing to note here, and this is not to pick on Justice Scalia, particularly given that he did not end up voting on the case, but he made pretty clear in oral argument and in other public statements what his position was. And one of the arguments that he raised in oral argument was this idea of mismatch theory, which is a long debunked theory that suggests that one of the dangers of affirmative action or race-conscious admissions was that you would end up admitting students of color who would essentially be in over their heads, that there was a mismatch between what that student was capable of doing and the expectations at the college or university where they were accepted. The data on this is very clear and overwhelming, and I raise it because I think first of all, that was in 2016. That same mismatch argument has been raised by some of the amici in this case, and I think it's in part because they believe that this court may be willing to listen or at least factor it into its decision in trying to determine whether the current regime is sustainable. And this is one of the issues that we tackled in our amicus brief in this case as the Center on Race, Inequality, and Law. We submitted a brief on behalf of the National Black Law Students Association, and that was one of the things that we wanted to make sure that we touched on, because it's, you know, beyond whatever legal arguments folks may be making, it's just a dangerous argument and a dangerous precedent to set when you start talking about this sort of mismatch idea and trying to convince folks that a lot of these students of color are not capable of finding success at elite institutions, which we know is just not the case.
Now, Jason, what do you think the Supreme Court is likely to do in these 2 cases involving Harvard and the University of North Carolina? And what is your prediction about how each member of the court will rule?
Yeah, you know, I wish that I was more optimistic about this. I think the fact that the court agreed to take the case in the first place is not a good sign, because if precedent is well established, there's no need for the court to revisit it over and over again. And, you know, in the same way that everyone became concerned when the court agreed to hear the abortion cases, I think there's the same trepidation here as we move into oral argument. So it's hard to predict. It's, you know, the fact that the cases were initially consolidated and have now been deconsolidated suggests that maybe the court will try to split the difference here in some way, or make some distinction in its ruling between what can happen under the 14th Amendment versus what can happen under Title VI. But ultimately, I think at least one of these programs is likely to be struck down. And I think that it's likely to break on ideological lines. You know, I think the justices that most people have identified as being more conservative, Justices Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Kavanaugh, Coney Barrett, and Gorsuch, are likely to vote to overturn Grutter. And Sotomayor, Kagan, and Brown Jackson are likely to push back to no avail, unfortunately. But we'll see. I do think, you know, that some of the allegations against Harvard seem a little more egregious in terms of the, you know, the allegations about intentional discrimination that may make a difference in the justice's mind. But we'll see, and I think, you know, we'll learn a lot from oral argument as well, and how the questioning shakes out.
Jason, unfortunately, we've run out of time. It's been so enlightening to speak with you. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, thank you so much again for having me. It's been my pleasure. You can follow the center's work on Twitter at @RaceNYU, or you can visit our website, which is www.law.nyu.edu/centers/race-inequality-law. And I appreciate the support.
Thank you so much, Jason Williamson, for being with us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The 1960s and 70s weren't just the time when protesters took to the streets to fight for civil rights and against the Vietnam War. It was also a period when radical lawyers defended dissidents and worked closely with them to bring their messages into the nation's courtrooms and more widely into the public sphere. Luca Falciola has just published a book about the militant attorneys who fought for social change arm-in-arm with activists. Breaking from the traditional role of lawyers, they identified with their clients and their causes, and they challenged the conservative rules and trappings of the legal profession. The book is Up Against the Law, Radical Lawyers and Social Movements, 1960s to 1970s. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. At the heart of this work is the history of the National Lawyers Guild. Founded in 1937, the Guild was established as an alternative to the American Bar Association, which was not racially integrated. Ever since Law and Disorder Radio began airing in 2005, our co-hosts have been longtime Guild members and leaders, and many of our guests are also Guild members. It is therefore our special privilege to welcome Luca Falciola to discuss his excellent and comprehensive book about radical lawyering and the Guild. Luca is a lecturer at Columbia University. His publications include the award-winning book about the movement of 1977 in Italy and several articles on various aspects of contentious politics between the 1960s and 1980s. Luca, welcome to Law and Disorder, and congratulations on your wonderful book.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Luca, you quote attorney Charles Gary as saying, "The courts are the last place in the world to make social change." Can you please talk about Guild member Ken Cloke's suggestion to stop being, quote, attorneys for the partisan and to become, quote, partisan attorneys?
Yes, here we are at the very core of a fascinating discussion that emerged among radical lawyers in the late 1960s. That was a debate ignited by the young generation of law graduates who somehow took over the National Lawyers Guild. These people were part of the new left and were truly embedded in the social movements. And because of their specific background, these lawyers were puzzled by the, I would say, disconnection between the promises and principles inscribed in the American Constitution and the harsh reality. Racism instead of equality, poverty instead of prosperity, war instead of peace. There was a crisis of confidence surrounding the law, the institutions, and the very foundations of the system. So these young lawyers started criticizing the law, the judiciary system, and also the professional role of lawyers in a way that was unprecedented. Drawing on Marx and Lenin, they argued that law is class law, that the legal system is an apparatus for preservation of the status quo, a status quo based on race, class, and sex exploitation. They would say that law is not neutrality, fairness, and truth, but a function of power. Courts are territory of the enemy, and legal reforms are, at best, palliatives. Radical lawyers insisted that law itself rarely breeds social transformation, because economic and productive relations are the dominant forces in history. Social movements, on the contrary, can change the course of history. But once again, judicial rulings and test case litigation are essentially useless and even counterproductive. All that said, how did they square this intellectual stance with their professional identity? First, they recognized that the radical lawyer embodied the contradiction between the values of a conservative profession and revolutionary politics. Then, a few of them basically resolved that you cannot be a revolutionary and a lawyer at the same time. But most of them, and that's interesting, strove to find alternative solutions, solutions by which you can be a lawyer, acknowledge the oppressive character of the law, criticize the limits of legal remedies, but keep on fighting in the legal arena. How? Essentially, getting closer to the movements, joining forces with them, identifying with activists, and eventually becoming a partisan lawyer.
Luca, Ken Cloke appears throughout the book. Why was his experience in the National Lawyers Guild noteworthy?
Yeah, Cloke, I would say that he perfectly embodied this generation of young radical lawyers that I just mentioned. He went south with the civil rights movement in the early 60s. He did not like law school because it was too conservative. But he was also a well-read and sharp thinker with a lucid view of the shortcomings of the legal system. So he joined the National Lawyers Guild in the mid-60s, first as a student organizer and later as an executive secretary. And he set out to connect the organization with the most dynamic social movements of the time to make the NLG the legal arm of the movement. And I found it interesting that while Cloak was an officer of the guild, he also sat, for example, in the executive committee of the Students for a Democratic Society. So he saw himself as an organizer with legal skills, to the point that one day he left the guild to work full-time with the GI movement against the war, where he essentially saw the most advanced revolutionary potential.
What is militant litigation, and what are the values of political trials?
Let me start by saying that political trials are as old as trials themselves. But when we think about political trials, we typically refer to legal proceedings in which public authorities seek to exploit the courts for political reasons. So historically, it was kind of difficult for politically controversial defendants to turn the tables on and take advantage of trials. Radicals were generally intimidated and victimized within the courtrooms, and especially during McCarthyism. They just wanted to limit the burden of repression using legalistic arguments and technicalities. Now, back to the late 1960s, in a time of social turmoil, when the realm of possibilities opened up, organizers and lawyers felt empowered. And that's important to remember. So radicals were neither scared nor isolated at that point. And they thought it was possible to turn the logic of political trials against itself. So they began experimenting with what I call militant litigation, which is, in a few words, a conscious strategy deployed not by the government, but by defendants and their lawyers to manipulate and even subvert legal proceedings to advance a political agenda.
You note that the Department of Justice, describing the threat of radical lawyers, conceptualized militant litigation perfectly. What are the four components of a political trial?
Yeah, first of all, militant litigation was meant to uncover the political motives behind the prosecution, to strip the charges of their hypocrisy, as radical lawyers would put it. And these would turn the accused into the accuser. Second important point, defense had to shed light on the economic and social issues that propelled the alleged offense under trial. So, for example, inequality, racial abuse, sexism, labor exploitation. So it became essential to educate juries and judges on the defendants' lives, social background, political creed. Third point, it was decisive to make sure that defendants were judged by their own community standards. So the Sixth Amendment guarantee of a trial by an impartial jury was to be read with the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So a jury of peers was needed, not only, you know, a generic cross-section of the community. So voir dire became a militant device, and attention to jury pools turned out to be crucial. Also, that's important to remember, statistical methods to investigate the orientation of prospective jurors in advance were introduced with a lot of success. And finally, militant litigation implied a certain, I would say, resolution in confronting the courts. So it did not exclude disorderly tactics and provocative acts, and essentially because they could draw the judge into overreaction and could show how corrupted was the legal system.
Luca, can you briefly describe what happened on the day before Law Day on April 30th, 1969?
Well, there was arguably the first, or one of the first, lawyers' demonstrations in the history of the United States. A couple of hundred lawyers and law students picket the federal courthouse in New York City, and attorneys Bill Kanzler, Arthur Kinoy, and William Crane took the floor and demanded the end of preventive detention, the lowering of excessive bails, more representative juries, better detention centers, and many other things, including civilian control of police. And it's interesting to note that since then, lawyers increasingly participated in demonstrations, in public demonstrations, because they're being lawyers. So that was kind of new, and the NLG itself urged its members and chapters to plan demonstrations, to talk to the streets, for example, against the war in Vietnam.
Luca, please tell us about the significance of the case of the Oakland Seven in California.
Yes, it was probably the first time that militant litigation clearly emerged. Facing trial were the organizers of the Stop the Draft Week, which had been a major act of resistance against the war in Vietnam, a week of demonstrations that basically upset Oakland, California, in October 1967. And leading the defense team were two radical lawyers, Charles Gary and Malcolm Bernstein. And to begin with, they decided to politicize the trial as much as possible. So the Vietnam conflict had to take center stage. And the defense argument was that the war was illegal, immoral, and genocidal. Therefore, according to the Nuremberg Principles, citizens had an obligation to prevent the commission of inhuman acts by their government. So in other words, the war resisters who protested and disrupted the functioning of the Oakland Induction Center were upholding the law, not breaking it. And it's interesting to note that to buttress this argument, lawyers called expert witnesses to testify on war atrocities. And Charles Gary kept on denouncing U.S. imperialism and repression all along the proceedings. So the trial turned into a sort of teach-in against the war, and it became an indictment of the government. Local activists also provided external support. Essentially, they showed that the Seven were not alone. And finally, the defense received more than 150 contempt of court citations, which was quite a lot, but the Oakland Seven were all acquitted.
What role did defense committees play at trials such as the Catonsville Nine in New Jersey and the Soledad brothers in Berkeley? And how did they broaden simple legal defense?
Defense committees were fundamental tools of militant litigation. They brought people into the streets and into courtrooms. They built and celebrated the heroism or martyrdom of militants. They raised funds. They attracted legal talents. They gathered endorsements. They provided support to prisoners, very simply. They exerted pressures on juries and judges. And they educated the public. As a matter of fact, they became engines of political engagement. And there were moments in the history of the radical left in which defense committees were the most powerful epicenters of activism. Let me remind you that this was not a new phenomenon, actually. It was a legacy of the anarchist and communist tradition, which was, I would say, resurrected and expanded in the 60s and 70s. I like very much the example of the Soledad Brothers defense committees because it showcases essentially all the functions that I just mentioned. It was powerful and it was capable of spreading the unlikely view that these three black inmates, the Soledad Brothers, did not kill a prison guard, but had been framed. However, this experience also demonstrates the limits of defense committees. George Jackson, who was the main beneficiary of the defense effort, grew skeptical of the chances to persuade the jury of his innocence. So despite an incredible outpouring of affection, admiration, and care by supporters, he increasingly believed that only a prison escape would have saved him. So he lost the confidence of his lawyer and lover, Faye Sander, and made the work of his followers complicated, very complicated. And then, as is known, a series of ill-fated and complex events eventually led to his murder in prison.
This is Marjorie Cohn here with my co-host Heidi Boghossian interviewing Luca Falciola about the history of radical people's lawyers. Luca, how did National Lawyers Guild lawyers shape a counter-narrative of the Attica prison uprising?
Yes, guild lawyers were at Attica from the very beginning. Bill Kanzler was actually among the observers requested by the inmates, and attorney Lewis Steele was sent there by the guild. Then other guild lawyers rushed to the prison gates to assist, collect evidence, and interview inmates. And speaking with inmates, radical lawyers and guild lawyers promptly realized that the official version of the events was the cover-up of a disastrous, bloody, and vengeful law enforcement operation. Indeed, police forces had killed in cold blood and exerted abuses and tortures on prisoners. And yet, the spokesperson for the Correctional Services Department declared that prisoners had murdered all hostages and that several of them had been found with their throats slashed. There were also rumors circulating about an observer castrated by the inmates. So, guild lawyers felt the urge to shape a counter-narrative. And they did it essentially in two ways, with lawsuits and with counter-information. So, first of all, they filed suits denouncing punitive treatments and retaliation. They also sponsored a class action on behalf of the Attica prisoners to compel the state of New York to prosecute Governor Rockefeller, New York Commissioner of Corrections, Attica Warden, and a series of other officers for crimes against the inmates and the guards at Attica, including murder, manslaughter, and assault. Then they informed the public through their own channels and through mainstream media, radio, TV. They basically denounced the campaign of systematic disinformation that was actually at play, a campaign that years later was actually uncovered. So they accused authorities of removing evidence and of spreading false rumors. And in retrospect, it's quite amazing to verify, as I did, that investigative commissions and historical research have overwhelmingly proved that guild lawyers were right. Then, of course, this accurate reconstruction of the events was paired with a celebration of the rebellious prisoners. So Attica insurrection was described as the bravest revolutionary gesture, especially because it was led by this multiracial front and was able to hit the most controlled of all institutions. But as we know, this was the classic partisan commitment of radical lawyers.
You devote a chapter to the Guild's mass defense program, which we're very proud of. Please talk about the role the Guild played in defending the young lords and what you describe as, quote, a remarkable case of intervention by legal observers.
Yes. Another major innovation of this period was the development and improvement of mass defense strategies, namely intervention protocols and legal tools to deal with the judicial troubles of activists who were arrested during demonstrations. The idea of sending legal observers to demonstrations and in other critical situations was one of these strategies and was somehow borrowed from the Black Panthers' notion of policing the police. And I guess that the case of the young lords in New York is paradigmatic of this approach. So, long story short, the young lords in the winter of 1969 famously occupied a church in East Harlem. They wanted to use it for their Breakfast for Children program and for their health clinic. The minister refused it, so they barricaded for 10 days. Inside and around the church, there were always about 150 people, including Black Panther militants. So it was very likely that the standoff would have ended with a brutal or even bloody confrontation. Hence, it was wise to de-escalate police and avoid incidents. So the guild offered to provide a 24/7 legal coverage, as they called it, and mobilized about 60 people between lawyers and legal workers to be there. Some of them escorted people in and out of church. Others gave legal advice through a sort of legal clinic. And when police finally enforced the injunction to vacate the building, and that was in January 1970, there were more than 20 guild people there at the church who provided a buffer between occupants and police. They negotiated the terms of the bust. They arranged the exit of supporters. They searched the church to certify that there were no weapons inside. And they reassured police that the lords did not want to resist arrest. Eventually, only 8 policemen entered the church. They were unarmed, and they were escorted by lawyers. And they eventually performed their arrests very peacefully.
And of course, Luca, the Guild continues to play a unique and leading role with its legal observer and mass defense program. How did Guild members publicize the repressive use of grand juries?
It was in the late 1960s, once again, that federal grand juries were first weaponized against political dissent. And it was the Justice Department of the Nixon administration that actually started using these former people's panels as devices to locate the enemies of the state and to gather evidence against them. As you know, grand juries were endowed with broad investigative powers, protected secrecy, and extraordinary authority to compel testimony. Something that happened actually without a lawyer. These powers, by the way, were reinforced with the Organized Crime Control Act in 1970. As a matter of fact, grand juries against political undesirable proliferated and essentially endangered all radical movements because it was a tip-off machine. And what I found fascinating is the fact that the Guild was so in touch with activists that instantly understood that this danger was important and immediately started working to acquire knowledge on this area of law. Grand jury litigation had little caseload and was developing very rapidly. So what did the NLG do? It undertook the task of training lawyers to counsel grand jury witnesses. It created a grand jury defense office that worked as a clearinghouse and as a training hub. Then the most experienced lawyers also traveled across the country to teach their peers how to represent witnesses. The Guild also published the first manual on grand jury law. And finally, it created a coalition with the ACLU and other organizations calling for a reform of these judicial tools.
Luca, unfortunately, we're running out of time. We could talk all day about this subject. How can listeners follow your work?
I have a website, lucafalciola.com, where I upload information about my research. And you are always welcome to Columbia University, where I teach a course, among others, on radical politics in European history. And I suspect that the topic may interest some of the listeners.
Luca, thank you so much for writing this book and for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.